This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Often rely on heavily processed foods or fast foods. The benefits of getting the fresh foods to people is huge.
So I've been speaking with Brian Allen of Zinger Farm and their efforts at expanding the access of families on SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, into the CSA, which is the Community Supported Agricultural Market, and bridging that food gap and allowing them to access fresh, locally produced, and healthy food choices. Is there anything else you want to say about this issue, Brian?
Well, I wanted to thank you and to just remind everybody that they can go to OregonSNAPCSA.com and find a farm near them that has a convenient pickup site and accepts SNAP.
Thanks so much for your time and your efforts.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Climatologists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, have called projected drought conditions in more than half the United States, similar to those experienced in the Dust Bowl during the 1930s. While conditions during the Dust Bowl were exacerbated by poor farming practices, climate change is a more significant factor now, according to researchers. The increase in greenhouse gases raises the temperature, which speeds evaporation and, in turn, makes it even warmer. 2013 conditions are already set to be worse than those of that last year, with states including South Dakota, Wyoming, Nebraska, and Montana already battling severe drought conditions as the transition to summer begins.
In the latest news regarding the ongoing water battle in Southeast Oregon, Governor John Kitzhaber declared a drought emergency for Klamath County last Thursday. Klamath Basin has long struggled with water supply issues, and this year saw unusually dry conditions, with snowpack at even lower levels than normal. Kitzhaber's executive order helps make farmers eligible for federal subsidies. One proposed solution to Klamath County's continued regional water concerns is to remove four privately owned dams on the Klamath River. Earlier this month, the Department of the Interior released an Environmental Impact Statement, or EIS, recommending the removal of all four dams. The EIS synthesizes environmental, political, and economic arguments to support the proposed $1 billion dam removal project. Supporters hope the statement could help the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement and the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement, or KHSA, move towards congressional approval. But some local residents oppose dam removal, fearing it would actually reduce water further in the area. Debate over removal of the dams aims to balance concern over tribal rights while still providing sustainable power and water to the area. Glenn Spain of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, who described the projected dam removal as a routine procedure, said the plan was a win-win. Spain called dam removal a path towards, quote, cheaper power, more reliable irrigation supply, and restored fisheries. Don Gentry, vice chairman of the Klamath Tribes, was impressed by the breadth and thoroughness of the report and said EIS emphasizes the cultural importance of healthy waterways and fisheries. But some have identified problems with language in the agreement. Felice Pace, an outspoken opponent of some parts of the plan, is concerned that the KHSA could exempt PacifiCorp, who builds and currently owns the dams, from responsibility for essential aspects of the cleanup. He is also concerned that the plan does not adequately protect tribal water rights. The agreements now need congressional leadership to move forward. The dam removal plan calls for control of the Klamath River dams to be transferred to the Department of the Interior by 2019. Preparation for removal of the dams would begin soon after, with all dams to be completely removed by 2021.
Interior Secretary Sally Jewell began work last week and is already facing challenges about management of public lands in the West. In collaboration with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Serena Fong has more.
Last week was the first week on the job for Interior Secretary Sally Jewell. The former REI president spent most of the week learning the ropes in Washington and the Department of the Interior. But there are challenges facing the new secretary about public lands in the West. Peter Dykstra with the Wilderness Society says he's optimistic about the choice because Jewell's past experience shows she understands the connection between conservation of America's public lands and a strong economy.
Businesses move to communities that have places that people want to live. Public lands near urban areas create the opportunity for great cultural experiences, but also those great outdoors experiences.
And he says it's not just tourism jobs. Places like Portland are booming tech centers with jobs in computer, aerospace, electronics, and other high-paying industries. Dykstra says the economic growth due to proximity to public lands also impacts small to medium-sized cities such as Bend.
They have new, very different kinds of jobs coming into those cities because of the access to the outdoors and the public lands.
Bill Dvorak runs outfitting trips on the Arkansas River in Colorado. He says his business draws clients from Colorado, the West, and even Europe.
People might come down and they do a day or an overnight trip on the river, and then we can take them mountain biking or horseback riding or teach them how to kayak or rock climb. There's a lot of other things that you can do in the area.
Jewel took over the post from Ken Salazar, who stepped down earlier this year. In collaboration with the Oregon News Service, this is Serena Fong with KBOO News.
A solar power company wooed to Portland 2 years ago through local incentives is reducing its Portland workforce. In a notice to the Oregon Dislocated Worker Unit, the company Solo Power said it would suspend operations at its North Portland facility. According to Sustainable Business Oregon, the company made the cuts to shift its focus to manufacturing and sales as it begins its first commercial shipments. The announcement comes after a public promise to ramp up its Portland workforce once the North Portland factory is complete. In May of 2011, Portland Mayor Sam Adams welcomed the solar power company in a news conference, announcing the company's pledge to locate 500 jobs at a $340 million North Portland manufacturing facility. With Wilsonville as its primary competition, Portland won the bid for the facility after Wilsonville residents created a petition attaching an urban renewal district to the bid. According to Solo Power, the delays caused by the ballot initiative were not conducive to its production timeline. Locating to the North Portland's Rivergate Industrial District made the company eligible for more than $15 million in tax breaks. In February, the Oregonian reported the company's missed production deadlines, including its target to hire hundreds of high-paying jobs. On June 17th, 29 workers will be laid off.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for First Peach Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's show is a special Earth Day edition of Prison Pipeline, looking into how the environmental and animal rights movements are related to the justice system. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be another sunny day, with highs up to nearly 70 degrees. Clear skies should continue into the evening, with lows around 44.
It's 5:12, time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Growing up in small-town Texas, I quickly learned about fighting, including this valuable lesson. You should never hit a man with glasses. You should use something much heavier. This also applies to fighting for our good earth against rapacious profiteers, the spillers and spewers, frackers and extractors, drillers and pipeliners who view our environment, communities, health, and happiness as barriers to commerce that must be shoved aside. The heaviest tool we have for striking back is the indomitable human spirit that, when pushed, produces a fierce feistiness, tenacity, and organized resistance. I can even put a name to this spirit. Nancy Zorn. She's a 79-year-old grandmother from War Acres, Oklahoma, who's refusing to be shoved out of the way of ExxonMobil, TransCanada Corporation, and other giants that are trying to force the massive Keystone XL pipeline down America's throat. That pipeline would carry a nasty, extra-toxic sludge oil from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, to oil export facilities in Port Arthur, Texas. The crude would be piped right through Oklahoma, where TransCanada already is underway with construction. Well, it was underway until Grandmother Zorn literally put her neck on the line. Using a bicycle lock on April 9th, she attached her own neck to one of TransCanada's huge earth-moving machines, halting construction. I can no longer sit by idly, she declared. It is time to rise up and defend our home. It is my hope that this one small action today will inspire many to protect this land and our water. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, TransCanada had Nancy arrested, but it can't stop her and thousands of other spirited souls from continuing to fight this destructive corporate greed. Join them. They're organized as the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance at gptarsandsresistance.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Environmental groups are opposing a plan to dredge a shipping canal on Washington's Lower Snake River. Last month, a coalition of environmental groups have submitted comments to the state's Army Corps opposing the dredging. Dredging of the waterway is necessary every few years to maintain its use as a barge transportation corridor. In its comments against the dredging, the group Save Our Wild Salmon argues that freight transport of the Lower Snake declined 45% between 2000 and 2010. The group criticizes the Washington State's Army Corps of Engineers draft environmental impact statement for not considering less costly shipping alternatives. To facilitate shipping on the Lower Snake River waterway, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers constructed four locks and dams in the 1960s and 70s. Since that time, environmentalists have been trying to get the locks removed to restore wild salmon that were lost when concrete construction blocked migration routes.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Kenneth Paris, chief economist with the Communications Workers of America, says labor and environmental activists came away from the Blue-Green Alliance Good Jobs, Green Jobs conference in Washington last week with a strengthened understanding of the need to work together.
It's a coalition where environmentalists recognize that the rights of workers and decent paying jobs and to have the ability to choose whether to be a union member or not without fear is critical to improving the environment. And you have unions who have learned that improving the environment is critical on the job, in the community, for their families and for the globe, and that we have to work together to move forward where we have good jobs, green jobs.
Paris says America's infrastructure is decaying and much of it is antiquated. China has more efficient electric grids, losing far less power as it's transmitted. Paris says big investments in infrastructure would create good jobs while improving the environment and preparing the nation's infrastructure for the impact of climate change. He says the broken political process complicates progress, but the Blue-Green Alliance can help empower working progressives to fight effectively for change.
We need to form a broad progressive coalition, an alliance, a movement to empower citizens to be able to take part in the process, the political process, effectively.
23 striking Teamsters sanitation workers returned to work Monday at Republic Services landfill in Youngstown, Ohio. The union says the workers never wanted to strike, but the company's behavior left them no choice. There were national solidarity picket line extensions throughout the strike. The Teamsters say for them, this strike was about the company, Republic Services Allied Waste, breaking the law. The Teamsters have suspended the unfair labor practices strike at Youngstown. Workers in Colorado are a step closer to receiving more protections when a company uses a defensive lockout in contract negotiations. Under Colorado law, workers are already authorized to receive unemployment benefits when a company engages in an offensive lockout. Such a lockout is used by companies to pressure workers to accept a contract. A defensive contract lockout is when a company locks out their workers as a repercussion for workers within the same industry striking against another company. Such a tactic was employed by grocery chains King Soopers and Safeway in 1996. The two grocers were in joint contract negotiations, so when workers at King Soopers struck, Safeway took a defensive posture and locked out its workers. A bill currently meandering through the Colorado legislature would extend unemployment benefits to workers being targeted in a defensive lockout. That bill is opposed by grocery chains and Republicans, but strongly supported by labor organizations and Democrats. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Across the nation, global warming is slated to become part of the school curriculum within the next month. developed in a coordinated effort by such organizations as the National Research Council and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. This move ends an era for which climate skepticism has been the norm in public classrooms. The old standards make no mention of climate change because the consensus about whether global warming was happening, as well as human involvement, had yet to be solidified. Many teachers have been skipping the subject altogether to avoid confrontations with conservative administrators or parents. The latest draft recommends that educators teach the evidence for man-made climate change starting as early as elementary school and incorporating it into all science classes ranging from earth science to chemistry. By eighth grade, students should understand that activities, such as the release of greenhouse gases from burning fossil fuels, are major factors in the current rise of Earth's surface temperature. Not everyone is sold on the idea of teaching climate change, however. James Taylor, a senior fellow at the Conservative Heartland Institute, which is developing a school curriculum that promotes climate skepticism, says the suggested stance on climate change is based on unscientific speculation and hype. Additionally, Texas, one of the country's largest textbook buyers, is among the few states that doesn't plan to adopt the science standards anytime soon. Texas also refused to accept the 2010 Common Core state standards in English language arts and mathematics that nearly every other state has adopted. Dieta Culbertson, a spokesperson for the Texas Education Agency, commented that it's not that we don't agree with the scientific information in the new standards, we just choose to write our own. That's how we've always done it. The priority is making sure the standards were based on the latest science, commented Heidi Schweingruber, deputy director of the Board of Science Education at the National Research Council. This was particularly important for evolution and climate change, which has become so politicized that scientists and educators feared students didn't know how to separate scientific fact from religious beliefs or political opinion.
ExxonMobil has established a tight veil of secrecy around their efforts to clean up thousands of barrels of heavy oil spilled in Arkansas last month. State and federal authorities have been visibly absent, and reporters have not been allowed access to the command center. The spill, which forced the evacuation of nearly two dozen homes, leaked a petroleum product called bitumen into the surrounding area. A similar, though larger, spill of bitumen in Kalamazoo, Michigan, 3 years ago still has the oil company responsible struggling to control the damage. The company transitioned from emergency response to restoration work last week and released an apology to local residents soon after. The accident remains under investigation. In other oil spill news, Florida recently became the fourth state to sue British Petroleum, or BP, over alleged irresponsibility that led to the 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster. Florida alleges that failure to change batteries on the rig's blowout preventer may have increased the extent of the spill. The suit claims millions of dollars of state revenue have been lost due to destruction of the pristine Gulf of Mexico coast. Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama have previously filed suit against BP and others, including Halliburton, over damages from the spill.
And now we go to the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, April 22, 2013. Hunger-striking political detainee Samer al-Isawi announces that he will stop his hunger strike and settlers attack his family. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian Minister of Detainees Isa Karakeh reported that hunger-striking Palestinian detainee Samer al-Isawi, who's been refusing food since more than 250 days, expressed a conditional acceptance of an Israeli offer to end his strike in exchange of his release on October 10th this year, adding that no official agreement has been reached on the issue yet. Karakeh said that Israeli security officers offered to release Isawi after spending 6 months in detention starting on May 7th in exchange for stopping his hunger strike that started on August 1st of 2012. Palestinian Prisoner Society lawyer Naeem Abu Ghosh said that Isawi insists that any deal should be written and signed in front of a lawyer and Red Cross representatives, especially since he does not trust the Israeli intelligence and security officers. Abu Ghosh added that Al-Isawi will stop taking vitamins if Israel refrain from presenting a legal binding agreement. Moreover, Israeli right-wing settlers attacked on Monday the family of Samer Al-Isawi as they were trying to attend the court hearing that took place at the hospital today. According to Al-Isawi mother, the settlers attacked the family and supporters when they tried to protest outside the hospital when they were not allowed in to see Samer. In other news, Israeli troops uprooted trees and bulldozed farmlands on Monday owned by Palestinians at the village of Beit Dajan, east of Nablus city in northern West Bank. According to the villagers, the army announced the area a closed military zone and started to destroy their farmlands. This is not the first time the Israeli army closes the area, uproot and destroy residents' farmlands, the villagers added. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, April 22nd news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hossam Kassis and me, Ghassan Barnoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Evan Owen-Stively, Sarah Smith, John Rasmussen, and the producer is Serena Fong. Special thanks to KBOO reporter Jimmy Tardy, as well as reporters from Labor Radio. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Interim Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Rebecca Ney.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with.
The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis, 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm John Rasmussen. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, hear Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 9 on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, hear The Fluoride Diaries, Part 16. Aquatic ecology expert Howard J. Patterson joins Abe and Joe to talk about the proposed fluoridation of Portland's drinking water supply.
On alternative radio, journalist and author Martin Lee speak on medical marijuana. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein.
At 11 on stage and studio, join guest producer and host Sarika Mehta for a special on gifted singer Kiran Aluwalia. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Terry Hopkins about two shows on incarceration that she has curated at the Art Gym at Marist University. Julie Green's show is The Last Supper, 500 Plates, and consists of 500 hand-painted ceramic plates showing what death row prisoners ordered for their final meal. And Buddy Bunting's The Prison Industrial Complex is a series of large-scale drawings on modern American prison. Thank you, KABU members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. There's still time to contribute. Just go to KABU.fm and click on Donate today.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, John.
Good night, Serena.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, April 22nd, 2013. In Mountain View, California, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, federal authorities release charges against the suspect in the Boston bombings as civil rights groups raise concern about how the case is being handled. As the State Department closes public comments on the Keystone XL pipeline, opponents continue a campaign of civil disobedience. And we'll speak to a leading glaciologist about the rapid melting of an ice sheet in the Andes, what it means for climate change, and how it's affecting the local communities.
For them, climate change is in the here and now. They have to deal with it on a daily basis.
Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Rescue efforts are ongoing in China today after a 7.0 earthquake Saturday in Sichuan Province. Survivors in outlying areas are still awaiting emergency shelter and rations, and anger is rising as help is slow to arrive. The death toll is up to almost 200. Many rural roads remain blocked after nearly 2,000 aftershocks triggered landslides. Local officials say that about 17,000 families lost their homes, and many others are also sleeping outside, afraid that ongoing tremors may cause damaged structures to collapse. In Syria, opposition activists say they discovered hundreds of dead bodies after fierce fighting in recent days near Damascus. Reports of the death toll range from at least 250 to more than 500. A statement from the local coordination committees of Syria claims forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad killed 450 people in and around Damascus during the past 6 days. The group claims hundreds were civilians, massacred and burned after opposition fighters retreated. Syrian state media reports that government forces inflicted heavy losses among terrorists. At a meeting of the Syrian opposition leadership in Istanbul yesterday, the Syrian National Coalition named a new leader after Ahmed Moaz al-Khatib stepped down. Longtime dissident and prominent member of the Syrian Democratic People's Party, George Sabra, will now serve as caretaker. Following the meeting, Secretary of State John Kerry announced that the U.S. will double its support of non-lethal aid to $250 million. While Earth Day celebrations were held around the world over the weekend, experts gathered in Northern California to examine the growing marijuana industry and the increased use of chemicals by growers. Many are pushing for increased research into the environmental and health consequences of using a product cultivated without regulation. FSRN's Eric Black reports.
In 2012, University of California Davis scientists did chemical tests on dead fishers, marmot-like animals whose habitat includes land often used for marijuana cultivation. Researchers found anticoagulant rodenticides in 79% of the animals. Their report blamed the exposure on contaminated soil and irrigation lines resulting from illegal pot grows on California public lands. But Pure Analytics chief scientist Samantha Miller sees another potential problem.
In the cannabis laboratory world, they're not testing to see whether rodenticides and things like that, mammalian poisons, are being pulled up into the plants. So I think that's another interesting area that actually as an industry we need to start to look at with the widespread use of these things.
Growers feel compelled to use the dangerous substances, according to Miller, because marijuana prohibition prevents them from buying conventional crop insurance. An April Pew Research poll showed 52% of Americans now support marijuana legalization. Six U.S. representatives introduced a bill last week that would require the federal government to respect state marijuana laws. Eric Black, FSRN, Arcata, California.
Massive protests against police continue in India's capital, New Delhi, following the rape of a 5-year-old girl last week. Bismila Gilani reports.
The rape victim is just 5 and, according to the parents, had gone out to play when she was abducted. The child's parents sought help from police, who did not file a missing persons report. Her family found her 2 days later, locked up in a neighbor's house. A medical examination confirmed rape and severe injuries to her genitals. The victim's parents say the police later offered them bribe to stay silent after they discovered what happened to the child. Protests over the incident continued across the capital for the fourth day today. The anger is directed at the police. Ranjana Kumari is one of the protesters, demanding immediate removal of the Delhi Police Commissioner.
There is no fear. It's not stopping. Somehow we are seeing the insensitivity of the police. They have just closed their minds, and this is not going to be acceptable at all.
India recently introduced a harsh law to deal with the rising cases of sexual crimes against women. The government has also taken several other measures for women's safety, following public outcry over the last year's gang rape of a young woman in Delhi. But the incidents of sexual assaults have dramatically increased since. Nearly 400 such cases have been reported since January this year in Delhi alone. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Nearly 200 people are dead in northeast Nigeria after fighting between the military and Boko Haram militants. Samuel Okocha reports from Lagos.
On Sunday, more than 185 people were found dead, many of them civilians, killed in fighting between the military and Boko Haram. The fighting began on Friday in Baga, a fishing community in the northeast Nigerian state of Borno. Soldiers surrounded a mosque where the suspected members of the radical Islamic extremist sect Boko Haram were housed. Military authorities say the extremists fired heavy machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades and used civilians as human shields. During the hours-long assault that followed, fires destroyed whole swaths of the town. The latest incident comes as the Nigerian government considers offering an amnesty deal to extremist fighters. Boko Haram, which means Western education is sinful, wants its imprisoned members freed and a strict application of Sharia law in Nigeria. Samuel Okocha, FSRN, Lagos.
For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina.